Accession number 28750, Reel 16.
Laurie Manton, Reel 16. Before we leave Bosnia or the Balkans, Laurie, could I just ask your opinion of the coverage of that war by, you know, war correspondents, journalists there, what the BBC, Channel 4 were showing? What do you think of that? Was it, from your own experience, a pretty accurate coverage?
Reasonably accurate. I think there was a lot of discontent amongst the major journalists that they wanted the world to know how bad it was, and yet when they transmitted opinion-changing film that was so terrible back to Britain, it would be edited out and a very bland news story would come in. And it was probably more than any other war where BBC journalists like, for example, Martin Bell and Kate Adie to a lesser extent, started to be more emotive in their reporting instead of being completely dispassionate. And I can understand their reasons for doing that. And where I was based at Vitez in the British Army base, the various cameramen from the national stations in the UK would leave raw footage, unedited footage on videotape, and I got a chance in my spare time to view those. And where, for example, you might see on the 10 o'clock news a woman wailing for 5 seconds outside a mortuary because her husband's one of many who've been massacred and their bodies are in there, the main footage on the videotapes I was watching was a 25-minute walk round the interior of the mortuary while the relatives were trying to identify the dead, so pulling back the tarpaulins to see who was underneath. And you really did hear the sound of sorrow there. It was horrendous. But I think a bit more coverage of that might have helped galvanise some of the parliaments of various countries in Europe to actually get on and do something and not wait so many years before having the concerted NATO effort. But I think it was very affecting for the national journalists.
How about the sort of the viewpoint towards the different groups there, the Muslims, the Croats and the Serbs? Would you say there was any bias in one or the other direction?
I think there was dislike and probably hatred towards the Serbs. And this is, you know, a media view, which of course they wouldn't publicise because the Serbs were carrying out all sorts of atrocities. But then despair at the Bosnian Muslims and the Croats for fighting each other at the same time when they would have been better combining forces to fight off the Serbs, which ultimately, after a few years, they did do, which made their position much stronger. But they just hated each other all the time. You know, it was a ridiculous situation, and certainly not, at that time, a civilised country.
Seems a very complex war to report on, given all the different groups within the Serbs and the Croats. And, of course, the Muslims, I suppose, the Mujahideen, which you have mentioned coming in.
Yes, that does make a difference. But when you hear Muslim and you look at today's trouble with insurgents, that's one of the big problems. You know, there are Muslims all over the UK, but that's who they are. And then there are terrorists, and you've got this ridiculous situation with the BBC higher up saying we mustn't call them terrorists, the people that bombed London. you know, they're bombers. Well, I'm sorry, they're terrorists. They're doing it for, you know, terrorist reason. But everyone now has, you know, a picture of these fanatical, not turban, but wearing shemags on their head, fanatical Arabic-speaking people who are, you know, trying to kill every Christian that they can. But in the Muslim parts of Bosnia, the only way you'd really know that they were Muslim was that the women wore peculiar wrap-round trousers, which seemed to have a baggy centre to them, so they were baggy to the knees. And if they asked you to take your shoes off before you entered their house. But other than that, they just looked like any other Bosnian.
So now we go to another very complex situation, which of course is Northern Ireland. And I wonder if you could tell me, you know, your experience there. I believe, was it 1991 you first went?
Yeah, although I started on Soldier magazine in 1988, because I'd spent so long serving the army in Germany, I was concentrating on places like that. While the other two writers were going off to Northern Ireland. And one of them, Bill Moore, came back from the Gulf. He was quite mature, over 60. And he died, which meant they were pretty well stuffed in getting someone else to do the coverage of Northern Ireland. So I said, OK, I'll go over there. And I arrived at Belfast International Airport with a photographer. And I thought I was being set up. I was uneasy about Northern Ireland, having been in the services previously. But our briefing was such in an unmarked civilian vehicle. The two soldiers in plain clothes who were taking us to where we were going to go, one of them passed a handgun in the back and said, if we get stopped by a terrorist roadblock, we'll start fighting them and you'll have to run off into the fields, but you'll need a gun to defend yourself because you're associated with us. Well, I pushed it across the floor to the photographer and he was pushing it back to me, and we spent our whole journey disassociating us with the with this gun. But that wasn't typical. But that was my first impression of Northern Ireland. And of course, every time we, as we went through the countryside, every time we were slow behind a tractor, my imagination was working overtime, thinking, good grief, is this slowing us up for gunmen at the side to have a go at us? But it wasn't. And I went off and I did the story. Now, I was fortunate enough to start going quite regularly to what was then known as Bandit Country, South Omar, and in particular visiting the security force base at Cross Maglen, which was quite interesting to get into because you flew in by helicopter. It dropped down inside the security base behind the high walls, and you jumped out and ran from mortar-hardened shelter while this thing took off and flew away as quickly as it could. So it was quite exciting, to say the least. And they had not that long before had a helicopter crash and burst into flames in the little landing area just a few weeks previously, which made life quite difficult for them, because it wasn't a base that you could evacuate. And certainly all the accommodation is hardened against mortar attack, which it needs to be. But going on patrol is quite interesting. because the Security Force base at Crossmaglen, I suppose it was a bit like the Alamo, really. It was sort of under siege from every side, a little bit offset from the town square, which was quite a considerable size. And they had a sanger with a lookout down on the corner on the edge of the square. And it was about 100 metres. And to get to this sanger, they'd open a hole in the little door in this protective fencing. A couple of Scotties would jump out, kneel down, aim their guns backwards and forwards. And you ran like mad down to the sanger, where a door opened, you hurled yourself in, and then you climbed up inside, and you were in the lookout and had a good view of the square. Now, it was known as the Baruki Sanger, B-A-R-U-C-K-I, named after a private in the parachute regiment, who, in the early years of the trouble, they'd come out of Crossmaglen on a patrol, and he'd seen a bike, ordinary pedal bike, leaning up against the wall, and being a joker, he jumped up on this and said, look, you know, wall of death, and the bike blew up because it was booby-trapped and he was killed. So they named the sanger in his honour. But it was quite an alarming thing to be in a sanger, because not too long beforehand, an IRA sniper with a very high velocity weapon had fired a round at the glass. And so there was a sort of impact mark with radiating cracks all the way around. But it wasn't cracked because it's so thick. But it's quite an unnerving place to sit and observe. And the people do a week at a time or so in this little sanger. And it's the operating area is only half the size of this room.
This little studio, yeah. Very small.
Absolutely small. Yeah. When you think two or three people operating in there, and you've got a desk at the big window, it's glass all the way round. They're very much on their own. If there was trouble, odds on the people in the Security Force base couldn't get out to rescue them. But it always was an unnerving place to be.
Could you explain to people who know nothing about Northern Ireland, South Armagh, what sort of population would be there? Would this be Catholic or Protestant? Or mixed?
Well, it was funny. At that time, well, most of the time that I was going to Northern Ireland, they didn't refer to Catholics and Protestants. There were nationalists. I'm blowed if I can remember what the Catholics were.
Republicans.
Republicans, yeah. But it was a huge Republican area. But there weren't that many towns and villages. It was farming land, which makes it very difficult to patrol. Now, all along the border with the Irish Republic, up on the hilltops and mountaintops, there were lookout towers, of which the troops would be flown into, and these would be surrounded by claymore, anti-personnel mines and barbed wire and such like. And they would watch what was going on, basically. That was their role. So they lived a very insular life, weeks at a time, up on their supplies, flown in when the weather was good enough. But it was an evilly terrorist place. They just wanted the Brits out, as they call them. Not that many miles away was Fork Hill, which I think has since been demolished. And that was another particularly difficult security force base in South Armagh to get into. You flew into that one. And that was an even smaller base. And that was in a village, and yet the village was such a hotbed of terrorism. And I went there with one particular unit who were quite unusual in their method of policing the countryside. And I went on patrol, and that's the thing. Everyone was wearing body armour and helmets and such like, except myself and the photographer. Because we took the view that if we started bulking up by wearing body armour under our barber jackets, then we'd look like we were off-duty soldiers dressed as civilians and be a target. So we always made sure we had cameras hanging around our necks and all the rest of it. But, you know, I went out on patrol in Fork Hill, and they'd go out and they stop the traffic. They put a mobile roadblock up and stop the traffic, check people's driving licences and such like. And one car was pulled up, and it was a suspected terrorist in there. And he saw me with my cameras, and he just beckoned me over. I said yes, and he said, "I know who you are," he said to me. He said, "Live in fear, because we'll get you." Which is quite alarming to have happen. And certainly in any case, because we were writing about Northern Ireland matters and the success of the armies, then we were in a position, even back on the UK mainland, that we needed to check under our cars every morning before we got in them. And doing that without raising suspicion, you know, I think my neighbours thought I had a permanent oil leak, because I always used to check to see whether the oil had come out on the floor beforehand as a cover for checking the car. But we then did another patrol from Fork Hill, where we'd been told about Robert Nyrack, who was an SAS captain that was captured and murdered by the IRA. He got the George Cross, but he his body was never recovered, and it's believed he was fed into an industrial meat grinding machine. But the guy who drove the other terrorists and Nyrack to his doom, because I think he was executed in a wood, lived locally in one of the houses. He'd served 10 years or something, then lived in the house, and was still a Republican. And they went, "Oh, we'll call in, we'll show you this guy." And they knocked on the door, and he came to the door. And they said, "You know, this is the guy that drove Robert Nyrack to his death." And understanding of this, Irishman was not impressed at all. I can't say I was particularly impressed. I think it was a pretty stupid thing to do. They can just point out the house where the guy lives, not go and knock on the door and physically show him to you. But like all things, you know, security forces have off days. I shouldn't think they did it very often. In that respect. But, you know, there's that sort of thing going on. And I made many visits to both Fork Hill and Cross MacGlen.
What were you writing up of these visits?
About the work of the troops and what successes they'd had, how many arms finds they'd done. But it was a reasonably difficult area to operate in, because it was more than a little nerve-wracking. If you went on patrol with the troops, you know, you went out all over the farmland. Well, you couldn't go through the gateways between the fields. You had to go through the hedges, because odds on there'd be an IRA booby trap bomb round every gateway, waiting to blow up any patrol that that went through. And I remember on one occasion arriving not long after a patrol went through in South Amar. They were just going across a field, and boom, one of the chaps there was vaporised by this bomb. And I remember the commanding officer saying to me, he was there 1 minute, and the next there was his shoulder, and that was all there was. The rest had vanished entirely, completely gone. So I never liked crossing field lines at all, and I never followed a path or anything like this. And then it became really, really dangerous, because the famous sniper with the 50 caliber assault rifle started operating in South Amar, and indeed the local Republicans used to put up on route signs a little warning triangle like a road sign, but it had silhouette of a guy holding this big rifle. It said danger, sniper at work. And I went out on a patrol, and we went down the road, and there's a very long road. You could see about a mile down the road, absolutely extraordinary. So you could be a mile away and look straight into the village square from, you know, the verge. And then we went and patrolled round, climbed over the wall, walked through the graveyard next to the church, and back in the base. And I said, I'm going to go up one of the lookout towers and see what's going. And I nearly fell off, because inside it's a rigid metal ladder. It's a nightmare if you don't like heights. It's no safety harness or anything. And I got halfway up, and there was this huge bang. And then I could hear people shouting things on the radio. So I got back down. And the very next patrol that went out had been shot at. And they'd come over the out over the wall from the churchyard, and the sniper had fired up the road, because they have a huge range, these weapons fire a very big shell. And it missed the guy. Took a big chunk of tarmac out the road and sort of almost took the wing off the car beyond it. Such was the impact of this. And people got really nervy after that.
This sniper, was he a well-known, you know, well-known sort of, you said a famous sniper. This was someone...
What everyone knew about the sniper, the thoughts was that he was actually American, Irish-American, who'd come over and done it, but it was never approved. But, you know, he had this weapon that was a super weapon.
It's almost like the Wild West, isn't it? You know, just the gun-toting and expert.
Well, yeah. Well, he could be a very long way away from you, a mile away from you, and fire. And such was the power of this thing. And, of course, the British troops had ceramic plates in their body armour over the heart, front and back. Which will stop most things. But it was only a couple of days later, after I'd left, that a patrol was doing a traffic check on the edge of the village with that view again, when he fired and killed instantly RUC policeman, who was actually dealing with the traffic, because the troops were there to deal with it. So it killed him, and then someone else got hit. and then they tried it elsewhere. A guy was doing a vehicle check, and they created, because of the problem with snipers, they created these huge armoured sentry boxes, and a woman and her daughter, their vehicle was stopped at the entrance to this village, and he just leaned out to read their driver's licence and was hit him in the neck, and he was dead from blood loss in a few minutes, sprayed bits of him all over the woman and her daughter and such like. And I think that really caused everyone to be really twitchy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite something when that happens, and there's a danger of that. There's an incessant strain.
Did you find in your articles that you were able to report this? Because it seems from what you're saying, it's, you know, a very difficult area for troops to be in, the nature of the work. Were you able to convey that, or were you censored in any way with what you could say?
Well, we weren't censored, if you like, until such time as the peace came. But then we knew enough that you just reported the facts, you know, and on patrol Sergeant so-and-so, you know, stop this vehicle and check that, and then the patrol moved on and did this, that and the other. You were reasonably general about it, because if you were to crow about the army's success, you know, the 1st Battalion of the Watsit Regiment has had a major success in, you know, sorting out the IRA. That's a slap in the face of the IRA, and they would do each come out and try and kill members of that battalion. So you had a heavy responsibility. But because it was the Army's own magazine, and it was going on the newsstands, you were fairly well stuck. You couldn't be like a sensational tabloid journalist, you know, who probably makes up a lot of the story, embellishes it. You could only report the facts, but you could do that in a lively way. It was a lot easier in the Gulf and Bosnia when you're writing about, you know, proper enemies being killed by your troops, because they weren't the same nationality as you. You know, British, if you like, makes life very difficult in how you do it.
Yes, I can imagine. You know, that would be the case. So you would have been there for these sort of short bursts, would you, Laurie, and then coming back?
Yeah, we'd go for a week, and then come back. I think my second story out there was when the IRA blew up that military hospital.
End of Reel 16, Laurie Manton.